Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. It's a story of glamour and scandal and political intrigue and a battle for the soul of a nation. Hollywood Exiles from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I was born in an igloo made of snow, 200 meters from where I'm living.
I'm Nala Ayed. Welcome to Ideas, and welcome to the unceded territory of Pavernatuk on the eastern shore of Hudson Bay.
I was born almost by duck team. It was middle of the night, and they didn't have any vehicles of any kind. My father said a young man went to get the midwife. He had about 100 dogs follow him. He was surprised there were no dog fight with 100 dogs.
And she made it back. She made it to the igloo on time.
Duck team ambulance, I always say. My name is Polsi Nwolingok. I'm from Pavernatuk. I lived here all my life. I never moved.
One of the reasons Paulusi has never moved is because his father made a stand.
When the Hudson's Bay Company decided in the early 50s that the village where they were trading was too shallow and the ships couldn't come inside. So he told my dad, who was the leader then, that they should move to another community with deeper water, which was Cape Smith at the time, was just north of here, 100 kilometers. He thought for a while, he went back and I told him, look, you can move, but we're not moving. My people, this is our land and we're staying here. We survived here for 1,000 years. We'll survive for another 1,000.
This is the first episode in a special series about change and resilience in Nunavik, the Inuit homeland that stretches from Hudson Bay to the Ungava coast, north of the 55th parallel, in what is now considered northern Quebec. We're calling this series Another Country, a title inspired by the work of Nunavik filmmaker Bobby Hanoyak.
Dear passengers, welcome to Pavernatuk. For your safety, we ask you to remain seated with your seatbelt fastened, your carry-on baggage safely stowed.
The village of Pavernatuk is reachable only by plane. In winter, Pavernatuk blends seamlessly with the frozen Hudson Bay, all of it blindingly white and snow quiet, mostly. This village has a long history of resistance. Of the 14 communities in Nunavik, Pavernatuk is the only one that has never signed the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement.
Pavernatuk has never and will never sell our birthright inheritance. We are, of course, not going to hoard these resources because we are a society and culture that shares, and according to our traditions, sharing is how we survived.
Both those ideas, autonomy and cooperation, are embodied in a slogan that hangs on the local co-op. The people of Pavernatuk, working together for themselves. And that is what we're calling this episode. We begin with a story passed down through the generations. It's a story Lisa Koperkwalik, now the president of the Inuit Circumpolar Council's Canadian branch, heard from her grandfather when she was a young girl in Pavernatuk.
I was a small girl, small bones, small. I'm 5'2". So he once told of the giant and the Inuk and how they fought. Inupak, giant, and Inuk faced one another. They fought, they sparred. But the Inuk was swifter and faster, though less strong than the giant. It's a bit like David and Goliath's story, but this is the Inuk version. So when he told that story, I'm like, that's right. I may be small, but I have these abilities as well.
Probably influenced very much your thinking about justice too, right?
That's right. My name is Lisa Khilukri Khobekwaluk. I was born in Puvernituk and raised by my grandparents. My grandfather was an Anglican minister, but he also very much valued our Inuit way of being, our songs, our stories.
It took a long time for Lisa Khobekwaluk to realize how growing up with her grandfather's stories shaped her.
But then I finally went back and heard my grandfather's voice. And I realized how close it is in me. And the stories, that those type of stories are our creation stories. You know, shamanism is the basis of our culture, how we deal with the Arctic world, how we survive in an Arctic world where others think it's impossible, but we made it possible because of how we innovate, how we create, how we see the world as it was created with our people in it.
Those stories are a crucial part of Lisa Khobekwaluk's inheritance, something she carries with her as she navigates a very different world than the one in which her grandparents were born. For Paulusi Novalinga, the inheritance closest to his heart is hunting. It's a tradition he inherited from his father.
He taught me how to hunt since I was 8 years old.
Do you remember the first time you went on a hunt?
Yes, I shot a polar bear.
On your first hunt?
At 8 years old, yeah. The guy was 9 feet long.
Wow.
They don't want to get bitten. So each time I got close, he sat down, was protecting his lower part.
But you got him?
Yeah, I went up very close. My father was screaming.
How important is a trip like that for a young boy in Puvernituk back then?
To me, it was like an experience that is passed on from generation to generation. But the authorities, like the school, the administration, the federal government, wanted us to stay in around the village and go to school. And we were made to even lose our language, but we didn't, not on this coast.
As a young man, Paulusi witnessed a series of changes that radically altered the Inuit way of life. When he was 16, he was sent away to a federal day school in Great Whale River, or Kujarapik, three communities south.
It was run by ex-priests and nuns as well, who ran the school.
What was that like?
Not too bad. We heard about weirder stories, but let's say we took care of ourselves.
Are you able to tell me what that means, we took care of ourselves?
I went to work on weekends in the Kujarapik repairing machines because I was a mechanic class as well. Most of the guys I went to school with, they have a job, but the other guys who went to other schools, they're dying as bums. They did nothing all their lives. They were too hurt or yes, they were hurt by abuse that was going on. Some were died out there, eh?
Yeah.
So I grew up in the time when they were residents of school. And I could 1 year later, I ran away.
You ran away?
Used to be one plane every week, and it landed on the ice on skis. We were on our New Year's break. When the plane arrived, I ran away into the tundra. Nobody found me. I had no more dogs when I came back. I looked around town and I saw only very few Eskimo dogs left. They had been shot by the RCMP and the DNA, Department of National Affairs, Indian Affairs. So they did that so we would stay in one place. We would be easier to gather, to make us work, or, yeah, it was kind of like killing a way of life.
In stories from the 1950s and 60s, people often talk about losing control. Agents for the federal government took a more active role in shaping life in the North. The Hudson Bay Company became a major force in the region. People started to rely on selling furs and artwork to the company to make a living, which meant they were at the company's mercy if its managers decided to move a trading post or to stop buying. Here's how Pavernatuck resident Aliva Tulugak described the situation in his book, A New Way of Sharing. We felt we were losing our old way of life, and with it, the ability to control our own survival. We felt more and more under the control of bosses that knew little of our culture and our way of life. But the people of Pavernatuck found an antidote and a way of regaining autonomy by forming their own co-op.
We are a society and culture that shares, and according to our traditions, sharing is how we survived.
This is Harry Tulugak. He's a leading Inuit rights negotiator, a former mayor of Pavernatuck, and a former manager of its co-op. That last one is a role that runs in the family. His father was the Pavernatuck co-op's first general manager.
And what drove him was he knew two cousins had starved to death when there was a Hudson's Bay outpost and there was a warehouse that had flour in it. And the Hudson Bay people were human, they would have given that flour to make bannock to eat, but he had two cousins starved to death. And he vowed to himself that he will do something about that. He laid the foundation with the help of the local Catholic priest, Andrew Steinman. We called him Umikalak because he spoke our language, but he spoke it better than I did. And he was very instrumental in helping to get the people to work together. And I have to say, it comes from literally from out of the ground, because the man heard that he could sell that soapstone in a little figurine if he made it well enough that people are willing to buy it. So he goes out with his meager tools, with his ice chisel and an axe, and mines that soapstone, produces a beautiful object. He sells it, it comes back to the people, and it comes literally from out of the ground.
The co-op began as an artist's collective. One of those sculptors was Lisa Koperkwalik's grandfather, Isa Koperkwalik.
So the co-op was so important to my grandfather that even when he was frail and old, and he'd always put his nasaq, his hat on, and sometimes, of course, he'd forget it and come back and grab it and go to the co-op each day. He was so proud of that co-op. And the co-op to him and to others in the community of Pavernatuck was the vehicle in which autonomy, economic autonomy, would be gained. And with economic autonomy, there would be gained the government, an Inuit government. And that was the principle of the cooperative movement. He once told me, we formed the co-op so we don't have to be reaching our hands out asking others for money. So imagine him and others already thinking like this in the 50s.
Its members are so committed to the process of being a good cooperative member that this is one of the strongest co-ops in Nunavik of the 14 villages. The whole system, through our federation, our Ilagisak, contributes over 300 million a year to our economy.
Incredible.
Annually.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Today, the Pavernita Co-op is a massive building of over 17,000 square feet. It's busy all the time. Outside the store, skidoos and all-terrain vehicles come and go. On a bright day, the silver and blue siding gleams in the sun. And there's a big sign in Inuktitut syllabics, which reads, the people of Pavernituk working together for themselves.
Just the meaning of that says a lot. That's how this co-op came to be. And now here we are. It's growing. It's big business now. My name is Yonasi Khinoyok Siwarabik. I work here at the Cooperative Association of Pavernituk. I'm the general manager. I'm new. I started 3 years ago. It's a very heavy job, especially for a new, younger generation, because we have the co-op store, the hotel, the restaurant, gas station, distribution of jet fuel and diesel fuel. We also have apartments, also a transit house, which is used for patients going to hospitals. When we shop here at Co-op, if you check your receipt, you will see a local tax of 1%. And that local tax 1% is being accumulated so we can use it for discounts. So these are the Arctic chars. The hunters, fishermen caught them out on the land. And then they come back with their sleds full of fish. Example, they can go up to 2,000 pounds per sled.
So it says here, Arctic char, 50% off ticket price.
Yes.
And how does that help? Well, I mean, obviously there's a savings there, but why do you do that? Why specifically the Arctic char?
Arctic char is the best fish I can say, because that's how I grew up, eating Arctic chars. It's helping a lot the community. That one fish can feed a lot of families too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and we know that it's healthy because we know where it's coming from. It's coming from the wild land.
The co-op also uses its local tax to fund major discounts on furniture, appliances, and groceries every December. And if there's any money left over...
The word profit doesn't exist in that system. It's called surplus. Whatever is left over is given back to the members.
Yonasi shows us around the bustling floor of the co-op.
This is one of my boss.
Hello. Hi, boss. Nice to meet you.
This is... Administrative Assistant General Manager, Riley.
Riley.
She has so many years of experience. Even if I'm the top boss, I go see her too sometimes. So that's why sometimes I call her boss. The thing is the hierarchy thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist in a co-op.
It's upside down. I'll tell you, the hierarchy that we usually see in South is general manager being on top. But for me, I don't want to be on top.
Okay.
I'm at the bottom, very way bottom. And then I have all my staffs on my shoulders. And then there's also board of directors on my shoulders. And then on top of that, there are members.
You can buy almost anything at the co-op. Groceries.
We always in the South hear about this section, yes, how expensive it is.
All the fresh produces have to be sent by air. If we send them by boat, well, they'll all be rotten, right? So we have to send them by air as fast as we can. That's why they are a bit expensive.
Sealskins and fur for making parkas.
We make our own winter clothing. These furs basically cut the wind.
Hunting equipment.
Even these knives for, these are good for skinning caribous. We even have firearms for sale. We Inuit don't have seasons, hunting seasons.
There's always hunting.
There's always hunting. It's part of who we are.
You can also buy toys, but these days, not that many.
The toys.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the That's toys. For us Inuit, the toys are a piece of garbage.
Okay.
We buy them. We bring them home, and then they're all over the place. 6 months later, they end up in the garbage. So here, what we did here in Co-op is we have asked our FCNQ support to reduce the shipping of toys by 75%. We no longer want garbage, basically. Toys are good for kids, but we have outdoor. I used to play outside in blizzard and I would have fun.
No toys.
No toys. Playing with snow, dogs, sledding.
When I first met him, Yonasi told me right away that Inuit live double lives. When we sit down in his office, he gestures out the window. It's a snowy day, and the sky and the frozen Hudson Bay are both completely white.
Outside the window, there's nothing. That's your thought. There's nothing, right?
Yeah.
But for me, you got everything you need to survive out there. That's where my ancestors came from, out there, where there's nothing. And now that I'm here, since I was born inside buildings, I'm forgetting who I am at the same time.
Tell me about, if you don't mind me asking.
Yes.
Tell me about that thing you told me about, that you there is a double life that you're leading.
Yeah. Most Inuit, we have two lives that we live every day. Like now, I live in a system that was created by the colonizers, let's say, and we can do it. Plus, we also have to, example, if I want to eat caribou meat, well, where do I go? I'm not going to buy it from here. I'll go where my ancestors went. I'll go out there, go hunt, go look. That's the other half of life we have to keep if we don't want to forget who we are. This system we now live on, where we have to make money to pay our bills, where we have to make money to eat food. It's basically making Inuit people wait for money and do nothing else. They wait for money. When they get money, they go buy food. They go back home. So all this system that was created and then imposed on us is killing our own identity. We are killing our own self.
Yonasi says he started thinking about how a money-based system shapes his life during the COVID pandemic.
Because you need to make money to eat food, right? Even you.
Absolutely.
But if I take your money away, what are you going to do? How are you going to eat?
It's a great question.
That's a question that you should be asking yourself. Because I asked myself this question. Now, this question that I'm asking myself is leading me back to my own roots, bloodline.
I know you say that living this way, the money-based way, is killing you, is to use your words. On the other hand, this is the community sharing.
Yeah, exactly. Again, that's why I said that this business is a big responsibility, because it was founded by our ancestors.
Like Harry and Lisa, Yonasi is a descendant of one of the co-op's founders. His great-grandfather, a renowned artist, was its first president.
So we are very grateful that our ancestors worked so hard to found this co-op. The very good thing about this money-based system is we are helping each other as a community by cooperating.
Interesting that you have this loyalty to these two different traditions from your ancestors.
Yeah. It's, I wouldn't call it loyalty. I would call it more like responsibility based on who I am. It's like a gift. So I have to be responsible. It's very challenging because, again, we have to live two lives in one. And now that the spring is coming, well, short staff will be happening very often, because many will be out there. And I have nothing against that, because, again, it's part of who we are. A staff that is telling me he or she wants to go hunting, I'm not going to say no. You don't have vacation days anywhere. You're not going. I don't do that. I say, yeah, good. I'm happy. Go out. Go out there. I'm happy. I'm not against it, because if I'm against it, well, I'm against my own self.
On Ideas, you're listening to a documentary called The People of Pavernatuk Working Together for Themselves. This is the first episode in a series about change and resilience in Nunavik. We're a podcast and a broadcast heard on CBC Radio 1 in Canada, across North America on Sirius XM, in Australia on ABC Radio National, and around the world at cbc.ca/ideas. I'm Nala Ayed.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
This is CBC Radio.
If the government is in a rush to settle the land claims, I'd offer a good suggestion, is that instead of going through all the legal procedures and spending all that money on lawyers and the time spent in the courtroom, I'd suggest that the Prime Minister of Canada or even the Premier of Quebec come up north, and we'll face them off with our oldest lady and put them maybe 50 to 100 miles inland and see who can survive the longest, and that would settle the land claim fastest.
That is from the 1970s, when Pavernatuk became the hub of fierce resistance to the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement. It's a fight that still shapes what Pavernatuk is today. It began when then-Quebec Premier René Lévesque wanted to build a series of hydroelectric dams and to pave the way for mining and forestry in the north.
The Cree of James Bay, who are most immediately affected by the James Bay Power Project, ratified in December. Opposition to the agreement was much greater among the Inuit of northern Quebec, who gave up all their rights and claims to territory in Quebec in exchange for $90 million and exclusive use of 3,130 square miles, or 1% of the territory which they traditionally use and inhabit. Opposition to the agreement is based in the Hudson Bay settlement of Pavungdatuk.
Our elders and leaders were trying to convince the rest of the all of the other communities at the time, please don't sign this. This is not what you're supposed to do.
Inuit rights negotiator Harry Tulugak.
You can't sell your land because our children, the future of our children, they have to survive out here. They have to live off this land. You can't sell it.
I was just a teenager when those discussions were happening. I could feel the tension and the anger in the voices of people who were expressing themselves.
Lisa Koperkwalik, the president of the Inuit Circumpolar Council Canada.
I worked for the community council as a student for the summer while I was home for summer. The mayor was Aisara Khinnoyua at the time. And he brought out this paper. It was a document to be signed because we are against the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement. And all of Pauvelnitomute signed this document, including me as a teenager.
How did that feel as a teenager to be making that stand?
I felt like I was very much a part of our own movement and expressing that we didn't agree with giving away our ancestral rights, our Aboriginal rights. My own great uncle would talk and say, we would be giving away our land if we signed this. And I completely agree. I agree to this day.
Birthright inheritance is a very big deal. I read the Bible, Genesis chapter 25, between Esau and Jacob. And Esau, the elder twin, sells his birthright inheritance to his younger brother, Jacob. And the consequences of that transaction are amazing, generational, all the way up to the New Testament. There's a reference in there about Esau did the wrong thing. He sold his birthright. And we have never sold our birthright, and we will not suffer the consequences of selling our birthright like Esau did. That was our cry to the rest of the villages, but they didn't listen.
Last Friday, the results of the Northern Quebec Inuit ratification vote on the James Bay Agreement were announced in Montreal. 95% were in favor of the agreement.
So Pauvelnitomute is known to be different from the other communities because of that stance. And that stance we took made us enemies of the other communities because the other communities signed on to the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement. And we're now the only one who has not signed on to it.
We were so forceful to the extent that the provincial government, we caught the ear of René Lévesque at the time. And he heard about Pauvelnitomute and Pauvelnitomute standing on its, defending its right to never sell our birthright inheritance. And he wanted to come up. So we heard he was coming up, and Aisara prepared that sign.
Everywhere we go in Pauvelnitomute, we keep seeing the same photograph. Harry Tulugak took it in 1979. Aisara Khinnoyua, the former mayor, is standing on a rocky hill next to a sign. In Inuktitut and French, the sign reads, "Welcome to Pauvelnitomute. Welcome to the territory that has not been ceded to the James Bay Treaty."
It's just so simple, but it comes from so deep.
That summer, I helped paint that sign. So, yeah, I remember. I remember using the paint and, you know, painting over each syllabic. All people arriving, going from the airport into the community, would see it.
So René Lévesque came?
He did. He had a good visit. He was given a beautiful parka by Lila Khalingo, and he smoked every minute while he was here.
René Lévesque went back empty-handed. To this day, the people of Pavernatuck hold fast to their opposition to the James Bay Agreement.
Even though the benefits to the James Bay Northern Quebec Agreement fall to us today, still the principle of not having ceded our land, not having ceded our rights, remains truly important to the people of Pavernatuck, because there's this movement now of getting land back. Now, it's a complete struggle. It's going to be an uphill battle. And how much land will we get back? We want full jurisdiction over, you know, that land.
But that was not the only battle the people of Pavernatuck would fight.
In the late 70s and during the 80s, we had an epidemic of suicides.
The 8th teenage suicide of the year on the Hudson Bay coast of northern Quebec. An appalling statistic, more than 20 times the Canadian average.
Young people came back from school. They were nothing to do. They were taught how to live down south. They couldn't practice their training here. There was nothing. No jobs. And that led to a lot of mishap, like drinking and drugs. And it started in the 80s. There were none before. None whatsoever, not in 100 years were there any suicide before the 1980s.
And then followed right in its evil heels was child sexual abuse. I remember those days to be dark, the darkest days that I've ever experienced in my life, because we had lost a lot of our own young, vibrant people who had a future. But for some reason, one of them did it, then the other one followed. It's almost like once a month for 2 years. I saw people walking on our streets, wailing. No words were spoken. They couldn't speak words. They were so hurt and so damaged by all the things that were happening. Once we had a group, somebody from Toronto and another place where they were Catholic, and they came to our church and they wanted to share the experiences they had. Being who I am, I ended up being the interpreter of the guys who were talking to the community in the church. But one evening, the first one, he stood up and he couldn't speak. He was just watching. And he told me something that was so profound. He's from Ireland. And he says, in Ireland, my neighbors are blowing each other up and they're killing each other. I've lived it. I've seen it. And then he said, but I've never seen pain like this. You would think a guy that saw all that wouldn't be fazed by this, what he saw, the pain that he saw from the community of loss and sexual abuse. I said, oh my goodness, this must be bad. this must be bad. And during that period, the people looked up in the spiritual sense And for 6 months, they lived practically at the church. And in the church, inside the church, people were expressing their hurt. People were expressing their anger. That's where everything opened up. And during those 6 months period, people were accusing each other and forgiving each other. And there was a light at the end of the tunnel during those 6 months.
So we had a lot of things to do, like make them remember how to live here and off the land. And that's what I've been doing. I started a survival training center, as well the cadet group, Junior Canadian Rangers.
One day, we came up with this. Well, we have these old rangers, these Eskimos, old Eskimos who have so much knowledge, and they're really into fulfilling their role as the military's eyes in the north. And a lot of the military people used to come here, and not just Bumundu, but all over, to learn from them, to survive out there. And we got this bright little light bulb one time, and they said, look at all of our children dying. How do we get them out? Well, if we have these old rangers, and they have all this knowledge that they're not really passing on now at that time, all these young people, old and the young, why don't we marry the two and say, this group that we're going to try something and we'll call it Junior Rangers. And a fellow counselor of mine and I started doing the legwork, approaching governments and the military and deputy ministers to the hilt. I mean, like, we had about 100 deputy ministers at one time.
Which colleague?
Paulusi Nubalinga.
And I started with the three communities. And the general said, if it doesn't work out in 6 months, forget about it. I went ahead, and in 6 months, I had 12 communities.
The rest I can say is history, because the Junior Ranger program is now a national program. It is national. It's all over Canada. And we didn't have to call it suicide prevention.
How was it suicide prevention, though?
The youth got so enthralled being out in the land, learning how to play the guitar, skinning a caribou, catching fish, things the kids didn't ever do as a group. Now they were starting to do that as a group with the older people. And that's how it became what I will never label as suicide prevention. I will never agree with all these regional 50 or 60 people sitting down in one big room, bawling their eyes out, saying, we should stop this, we should stop that. How do we stop suicide? That's a bunch of bunk to me, because I've seen a real way, an approach of getting youth involved so much in life that they will not even entertain anything like this.
Since the 1980s, Pervernatuk has faced other difficult years and other social crises. But Paulusi says they are still trying to create their own solutions.
We run the elders' home, prisoner integration group.
And the land?
Yes. In fact, my sons are, two of them are teaching young criminals who would otherwise be in jail. But we're making them provide to the elders the fish they catch, the animals they catch when they're learning how to do it. That's important. Because that's what, first of all, makes problems. Lack of knowledge and how to subsist and live on the land.
Paulusi and others have fought to revive the dog sledding tradition that was almost wiped out. There's now even an all-Nunavik dog sledding race.
We do know what we need, but we're still trying to find those mechanisms where we can help our people the way we want to, the way we are meant to, as Inuit to Inuit. When we try to adapt one program that comes from the Western world to ours, it just doesn't work.
I know it's a big question, but when you say we know what we need,
yes.
can you just give me a glimpse?
The respect of our rights is to be a self-determining people. We are running our own programs. Ideally, we are creating our own programs and we're making our own laws. And these laws are based on Inuit values. These laws are based on those values. And we have to also realize that those values, they are enduring and they are fundamental. And we can't regard them as traditional. They are living and we adapt them to our contemporary lives.
Lisa Koper-Kwalik doesn't see Inuit life as defined by a conflict between tradition and modernity. Instead, she says, Inuit communities like Pavernatuk are indigenizing modernity.
Traditional is versus modern. And, you know, unless traditional, the term is used for an adjective of something, I don't mind. But when we pitch the Inuit world against a modern world, it means that we're a traditional world against a modern world. So I don't see the world like this. But indigenizing modernity, let's say, as an indigenous people, we are part of this society where we take part in rulemaking, we take part in the decisions that impact the Arctic, that impact our communities in an equal way to all others. Our language is part of the society. We are speaking our language fully. You know, our knowledge is constant and living.
You've seen so much change in the time that you've been alive, like Pavernatuk back then and Pavernatuk now, and just how you're describing how the co-op has contributed to society and the despair of the 80s and 90s and or the late 80s and 90s. What's the single most important thing that's contributed to Pavernatuk's existence today?
The cooperative movement. People knowing that they truly can work together, that their lives can and will be improved by doing it together. And as a result, you can stand on your principles of this land is ours. We're not going to sell it because too many people from the past did what they could to survive to get us here. My great-grandfather had an experience that's just absolutely phenomenal. The family was always moving, nomadic. In the wintertime, they're out there in the island just off the coast of Iwuyivik. It's about 90 kilometers off the shore. They were going out every day. The men go out every day to harvest the seal. The seal is a source of food. It's a source of clothing. It's a source of heat because of the oil. It sustains life. So you do what you can to go out there in minus 50. The currents are so strong there. There are times when the solid ice that you thought you were on gets separated from the actual solid ice, and that's what happened to the man. His name is Paksawaluk, and this is my grandfather's father. He's cut off from solid ice with his dog, who was a sniffer for the seal holes. From Mansell Island to Inuktitut, 406 kilometers as the Tuluguak flies, as the crow flies. Yes. But he's popping from one ice pan to the other, to
On a piece of ice.
On a piece of ice. going here, going there, going here, going there. And the knowledge, the cultural knowledge is such that once this happens to you, because it did happen on a reoccurring basis, here's what you do. And that's what he did. He said, you see the sun, you go towards the south, the sun. Otherwise, you'll be going out into the Hudson Strait and nobody will ever see you again. You go away, you go against the current that's trying to take you out, and you go south. And that's how he ended up in Inuktitut. It's an amazing survival actual event that tells me I can do anything. I can do anything to survive.
You owe it to that grandfather.
Yes, I do. Yes. My father did. My grandfather did. My son, his son, and his children, and all the others. So there's just generations to come. We owe it to them, having survived all that, not to wimp out, but here to stand and to have dignity and stand on our integrity, of their integrity, and honor them. And that's where we stand. And it's amazing. Like, it's just, no, I will not give up on anything. I can't. We can't be people who just give up against a little adversity.
Yeah. A little adversity.
A little adversity.
Yeah. Sounds like a lifetime of adversity.
Yes. Adversity in the sense that they think that big government is this big scary man hiding behind a, what do you call it, an imaginary crown. The government likes to say the crown this, the crown that, but he has no other generations before him or past him. Here buried, dotted along throughout the whole of Nunavik. Like, I know where my great-grandfather lies on my paternal side, just up here.
Wow.
I know where my great-grandmother lies in Ivujivik. My grandfather is here. There are lots of graves at Isuksiyevik, at Nanoktuk Hill. There are nine graves on that. Where it's 70 kilometers here where my father grew up. But none of Reni Levesque's people are buried here. Or any of the Canadian prime ministers. They're not here.
No.
So that's where I stand. That's where I stand on my birthright.
On Ideas, you were listening to the people of Pavernatuk working together for themselves. This episode was produced by Pauline Holdsworth. Special thanks to the people who welcomed us to Pavernatuk and spoke with us for this story. Paulusi Novalinga, Carol Bohm, Wani Bohm, Palusi Napartuk, Harry Tulugak, Eliasi Saluwalak, Peter Boy Itakalak, Yonasi Sivarapik, Lucy Kalingo, Julian Dufresne, and Lisa Koprakwalak. At CBC, thanks to everyone at the CBC Library Partnerships Program and at CBC Archives. Thanks also to Saluava, Duncan McHugh, Garrett Hinchy, Michael Dick, and Robert Doan. The next episode in our series is about Sanak, the first novel written in Inuktitut. It follows an outspoken young woman in Nunavik as she and her community navigate the changes set in motion by the arrival of Southerners.
I learned from my mother's book, we have to be ready. And I learned from this book, the family, they were really help each other. If they were not helping each other, we won't be here.
It's a history book. It's a philosophy book.
Yes.
It's teaching you how to live.
Yeah.
That's coming up in the next installment of our special series on change and resilience in Nunavik. Technical production, Danielle Duval. Our web producer is Lisa Ayuso. Senior producer, Nicola Lukšić. Greg Kelly is the executive producer of Ideas. and I'm Nala Ayed. And by the way, we're happy to announce that filmmaker, writer, and political organizer Astra Taylor is our next Massey lecturer. Please visit our website, cbc.ca/ideas, for more information.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.